Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's Dharma Talk is entitled The Short Vajradhara Lineage Prayer by Lama Tom Broadwater. This short prayer outlines the Kagyu path in a very concise and beautiful way. We will briefly explore the meaning of this prayer using the Jawan Karmapa's teaching, and we will focus on its practice implications. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Good morning and welcome to the 11:30 Columbus KTC Dharma Talk. My name is Lama Tom Broadwater, and I have the privilege of being able to teach here. I'm really appreciative of the fact that you are here today. The fact that you came is meritorious in itself. You could have done a lot of other things besides coming here. There are a million different distractions out there in the world. It's still a very beautiful day. You could have been doing something else. So thank you for coming. We don't have the kind of difficulties that maybe our lineage masters had in getting the Dharma, but we have our difficulties. And it's overcoming those difficulties, whether it's just getting out of bed, that makes this a meritorious thing for you to do. So again, thank you all for being here this morning. We'll begin by taking refuge. If you don't mind, it's on the laminated sheet, and it's the refuge prayer. And we'll say it in English, and we'll say it three times. In the Buddha, the Dharma, and the assembly most excellent, I take refuge until I reach enlightenment by the merit of generosity and other good deeds. May I achieve enlightenment for the sake of all beings. In the Buddha, the Dharma, and the assembly most excellent, I take refuge until I reach enlightenment. By the merit of generosity and other good deeds, may I achieve enlightenment for the sake of all beings. In the Buddha, the Dharma, and the assembly most excellent, I take refuge until I reach enlightenment. By the merit of generosity and other good deeds, may I achieve enlightenment for the sake of all beings. Again, thank you for being here this morning. So the topic I chose to talk about today is a prayer, actually. It's a short prayer, Vajradhara, and it's well known. It's a well-known prayer. When I was doing the summers for the last maybe 15 years, when Kempo Karta Rinpoche was still living, every summer, every session began with this prayer. So I have a great deal of fond memories about it. It's a beautiful prayer. It's beautiful because it lays out for us how we come to know our own mind. It's written by a fellow by the name of Bengar Jampo Zampo, really an extraordinary fellow. He was the student of the sixth Karmapa and was actually the teacher of the seventh Karmapa. Between those times, he spent 18 years on an island in Tibet called, on a lake, on an island called Sky Lake. I happen to have had the privilege of seeing that place. It's a very sacred place, but can you imagine meditating for 18 years? So out of his realization, he wrote this prayer. And so it's rich in that respect. So when we say it, we're getting the blessing of someone who spent all that time getting realized, you might say. So let's take it out. It's in the red book, the first prayer. And if you don't have a red book, there are two sheets. I think they will correspond to what the red book says. We're going to find that out, won't we? So let's begin, and we'll say it in English. Great Vajradhara, Talopa Naropa, Marpa Milarepa, and Lord of the Dharma Gompopa, Knower of the Three Times, Omniscient Karmapa, Lineage Holders of the Four Great and Eight Lesser Schools, Drikun, Taklun, Sapa, Glorious Drupa, and others, you who have thoroughly mastered the profound path of Mahamudra, unrivaled protectors of beings, the Dakpo Khaju, I pray to you, the Khaju Lamas, grant your blessing that we may follow your tradition and example. Detachment is the foot of meditation, it is taught. Attachment to food and wealth disappears. To the meditator who gives up ties to this life, grant your blessing that attachment to ownership and honor cease. Devotion is the head of meditation, it is taught. The Lama opens the door of the profound oral teachings. To the meditator who always turns to him, grant your blessing that uncontrived devotion be born within. Unwavering attention is the body of meditation, as is taught. Whatever arises is a fresh of thought. To the meditator who rests there in naturalness, grant your blessings that meditation is free from intellectualization. The essence of thought is Dharmakaya, it is taught. They are nothing whatsoever, and yet they arise. To the meditator who reflects upon the unobstructed play of the mind, grant your blessing that inseparability of samsara and nirvana be realized. Through all my births, may I not be separated from the perfect Lama, and so enjoy the glory of the Dharma. May I completely accomplish the qualities of the path and stages and quickly attain the state of Vajradhara. It is really a beautiful prayer, and it encapsulates the very essence of our lineage. Basically, the prayer outlines all the important stages that we have in training to reach Mahamudra. And we'll explain that term in a minute, what Mahamudra means. Basically, if you look at the outline of the prayer, it begins with what we call a field of merit, all those individuals noted there in the beginning. So what we do when we say this prayer, we imagine this field of merit, these individuals in front of us, above our heads. So that's the first part. The second part, the prayer talks about renunciation or revulsion. Then it talks about devotion to the guru. Then it talks about undistracted meditation. And finally, it talks about penetrating insight. Then it comes to a dedication. So those are the elements to this prayer. And they basically are the steps we take to Mahamudra. Now, the first part, all those individuals indicated there in the prayer, they're the lineage masters. They are the ones that realize Mahamudra, and from their mouth to their students' ears, taught them Mahamudra, what it was. Lineage can be, you can see lineage as two things. One thing, you can see it as an unbroken spiritual line that begins from the source and continues from generation to generation. Kempo Holmes has identified two types of lineages. The first is the external one, the unbroken line of realization that goes from the guru to the student. That's the first one. But and that's external. But there's an internal lineage, and that is our Buddha nature, which has always been there, always will be there. We just haven't recognized it yet. But it is an unbroken line from beginningless time until now, this lineage, this internal lineage that is within us. And so here's the trick. When the causes and the conditions are met, and this external, these teachers, that lineage in the person of the guru, and the internal lineage from the suited students meet, then we see our nature, our true nature. So the external, which is the teacher who has the lineage, points out to the worthy student the nature of their mind. That student gets it, understands, appreciates, realizes the nature of their mind. So this prayer is about, how do we prepare for that day when we actually meet the teacher that points out the nature of our mind? This is all about that, how to prepare. So let's begin by looking at, first of all, let me tell you, I'm still working on this. I'm not there yet, so don't worry about that. You know, I'm not trying to tell you that by my teaching this that I'm doing anything else than repeating the words of masters. So let's define what Mahamudra is. First of all, it's the very heart of our lineage. And it emphasizes working with our mind. Mahamudra brings about a direct connection between you and your true nature. Elizabeth Callahan, a remarkable translator and a wonderful teacher, says, and I quote, "Mahamudra is the nectar and the fruit of the Buddhist path. It is our mind's nature with its empty yet vivid presence." Empty, you know, if you look to see where your mind is, where is it? I mean, does it have a color, shape? I mean, what size is it? You can't find it. But on the other hand, you experience, so you have a mind. Now, we can say these words, but to actually experience it takes a little bit more than that. So, and I continue to quote what she said, "Mahamudra instructs us how to find that empty, vivid awareness within each moment, each thought, each breath. The term Mahamudra is used to refer to both the nature of mind and the techniques for its realization." So let's go back to the beginning of the prayer. In my last talk here, we talked about all those folks that are mentioned there. And we'll just do a brief review. The first you, I call it person, but you really wouldn't call it a person. The first person mentioned is Vajradhara. And Vajradhara is the primordial Buddha that pervades everything and is the essence of all things. Kempa Karta Rinpoche referred to Vajradhara wisdom as the state of great unity. So the first person mentioned in the prayer is actually Talopa. When Talopa attained realization, his mind mixed with the state of wisdom of great unity, and in that state, he received all the teachings of the Mahamudra from Vajradhara. According to our tradition, a lot of time passed between the time the Buddha spoke these words, gave these teachings on Mahamudra, and their wider propagation through Talopa. So there was a time. And it was in Buddha's wisdom that he decided when the right time would be. So the next person is Naropa mentioned, and he's a student of Talopa. He was a great scholar. Let's put it this way. Basically, Talopa tormented Naropa in about every possible way he could do that. The story is that Naropa just wasn't getting it. So one day Talopa just went upside the head of Naropa, hit him, slapped him, and he actually fainted at that point. And the story is that once he woke up, he got it. So there are a number of ways we get Mahamudra, but in the case of Naropa, he was slapped upside the head. So we could look at each person in this prayer, and we could see that each one of them struggled to attain realization. And so remembering these stories, it helps us realize that the hardships and the problems we have in learning Dharma, learning teachings, and getting towards Mahamudra, they're with a purpose. They're a means to genuine development. Kempo Karta Rinpoche said 30 years ago, if we can understand these difficulties we have learning about the Dharma, if we understand that and see these difficulties as a means to purify our karma, and if we mix these troubles with taking and sending, which is Tonglin, taking on suffering of others and giving out our kindness and love. If we can mix all that together, then these very obstacles that we observe and experience getting towards realization, if we can do that, then that's an essential part of our practice. So it's not like, oh, I have to get through these obstacles to get. They're a part of the practice. Every great master had to go through problems. Why would it not be so for us? We're going to have trouble. Actually, these troubles are wearing away our defects and accumulating merit. And anybody who has spent any time on this path knows that. Maybe at the moment they don't recognize it being so, but subsequent, all of a sudden you realize that was, I needed that to get rid of my pride or my anger or whatever obstacle we may be facing. We needed that obstacle in order to overcome those kind of problems. So it's an essential part. The prayer also mentions Marpa. He was a student of Naropa, and he traveled three times to India. Again, a very difficult thing to do. And the thing about it was that when Marpa did get it, Marpa's personality exploded. He became totally engulfed in compassion, intelligence, and diligence. So here's the point. Just simply hearing the teachings not enough. We actually gotta incorporate them in our lives. It's nice to hear teachings, but they won't do us any good until or unless we're willing to integrate them in our own body, in our own practice, in our own lives. Then we meet Milarepa in the prayer. He's a well-known Tibetan yogi and saint. We won't tell his story here, except to say that because of his diligence, his practice, and realization, the teachings have come down to us in a very pure way. Then finally, we have Gompopa, and he was a student of Milarepa. He was really a very smart fellow. And he was a monk, and he had lots of practice before he met his teacher, Milarepa. So it didn't take him very long, they say a year. It took him just a year to understand all the teachings that Milarepa gave to him, because he was a really smart and accomplished person. But they do say that after all those teachings, he still stuck around for a while to meditate. Are you getting the idea here that these folks, that it's not just something that happens and it's all there. Sometimes it takes a long time. We were talking about that in Nundra today, that it does take time. We have to familiarize ourselves. And familiarization is another word for meditation. So, Gompopa stuck around for a while to become really familiar with what Milarepa was teaching. And then the final person mentioned there is Dusun Kempa. And we don't have the time to go into his story, but to make a long story short, he posthumously became known as the first Karmapa. He is the holder of the lineage, and he's, you might say, holds a leadership role within our lineage. And he passes that on to the next generation by way of Tukul, by way of incarnating and in another life, because he has this great urge to teach and to carry on the lineage. So I'm going to read the next section, if I could. Detachment is the foot of meditation is taught. Attachment to food and wealth disappears to the meditator who gives up ties to this life. Grant your blessing that attachment to ownership and honor cease. So what's this all about? In the prayer, the word is Shenlo. That's supposed to be the foot of meditation. What are feet? Feet get us from one place to another. So this Shenlo is what gets us from our unenlightened state to a more enlightened state. It's how we make progress. So what is Shenlo? Well, the Karmapa likes it translated as revulsion. The Karmapa says, it's like you're walking down a road in your bare feet and you step in mushy dog poop. That's what he said. I'm not making that up. That's what he said. And what happens when you get in mushy dog poop? You say, ugh. You're sort of revulsed by that. It's that kind of feeling. That kind of feeling of revulsion that moves us forward. Ken Holmes says that the Jinlo currently among Tibetans means car sickness. It's that feeling of, oh God, will this never end? Anybody in here ever experienced car sickness? No? Oh, there's a couple. Okay. It's awful, isn't it? So this is what moves us. There's another great teacher by the name of Jetson Goutson, a Sakya teacher, and he defines Shenlok in terms of detachment and fixation. And he says, if you're attached to this life, you are not a Dharma practitioner. If you are attached to samsara, there's no renunciation. If you're attached to your own benefit, you lack love and compassion, bereft of bodhicitta, the heart and mind of enlightenment. If fixation arises, you don't have the view. So there are different ways of looking at this idea of Shenlok. And the idea here is we can't strain ourselves for something we don't have. You know, I mean, that's discouraging. If I were to say to you, you must right now have complete detachment from worldly things, you would all get discouraged, get up and walk out, and I wouldn't blame you. There's no point in straining for something you don't have. So there are really people coming to Dharma centers or other places, spiritual centers. There's three types of people, according to Gompopa. The first type of person that comes into this room simply want to be a decent person. They come here because they yearn to be fully human, to be decent people. And those folks, they're revulsed by suffering they have inflicted on others and on themselves. And they want to avoid hurting themselves and other people. That's the first type of person. Then there are people who are revulsed by worldliness. They're like the monastics. Things that attract us don't attract them. And they're willing to give up all worldly pursuits. They're sick and tired of being confused, both in mind and heart. And then there are a third type of person that come to Dharma centers and to spirituality within the Buddhist tradition. And we call them bodhisattvas. And they want to overcome suffering, not just for themselves, but for all beings. So there's really three types of psychologies working on here. There's decent people revulsed by harmful actions, things like killing. They even have a very strong sensibility about killing insects. They've developed that. But decent people still enjoy things of this life, and that's okay. The monastics, they're revulsed by worldly pursuits, both pleasurable and unpleasurable. And they don't care about being around bodies like us. They're revulsed by lust and attraction and those kind of things. And then the final person that we were talking about, the bodhisattva, that person is revulsed by what? Selfish ego. They see samsara as an endless cycle of suffering that's inside themselves, the negativity of their own kleshas. We have to be careful here, though, as bodhisattvas, and we're all aspiring bodhisattvas, right? We have to be careful about this. Revulsion about ego and how that is handled is really important. We have to be careful. It has to be done in a very healthy way. And the healthy way is to recognize that through all the crap we do and all the unskillful things we do, underneath there is this Buddha nature. So we treat our bodies well because they, for the time being, embody this Buddha nature. But we still are revulsed by all of our hatred, all of our lust, all of our anger. It repulses us, and we want to get away out of that. But again, at our center, our nature is open and spacious. We call it Buddha nature, you call it what you want. But there's that purity that is within us. So when emotions and negativity draw us away from this center, that's what causes revulsion in us, according to the Bodhisattva way. The fact is, in our training, we need to continually return to the center. You know, we may be swayed by our emotions from time to time, but we come back to that center, and it's a practice. We may have to do that 100 million times before we depart this world, but that's the practice of a bodhisattva. Lama Adam gave a talk recently on meditation on the dot. It's sort of that idea of returning to the center. So we really have to meditate deeply on this idea of revulsion. One of the ways we can do that is using the four thoughts that lead us to the Dharma. You can find that on Lama Kathy's website, I believe. And I'm going to paraphrase those for you, but go to her site for the exact words. But here's a paraphrase of that. The first is contemplate that your life, my life, everyone's life is so precious. But chiefly because it is an opportunity to seek and find the liberating truth. That's why life is precious. The second thing is we recognize life is very, very fragile. Any of us could walk out today and drop dead on the spot, run over by a car. You know, I could have a heart attack. You never know. Life is that fragile. And it's good to think about that once in a while. Because if we think about that once in a while, we're not going to waste our time. We'll be more like Milarepa. Maybe not like Milarepa, but more like him. If we recognize you and I don't have a lot of time. I'm 74 years old. And I don't believe it. I feel like my mind is like a 25-year-old. I'm thinking, where did all those years go? Life is short and it's fragile. Let's not waste our time. Let's pursue what's true. The next thought is, our actions have consequence. We need to be aware of what is happening in our mind. We question ourselves to see what actions we perform and thoughts we think. And are those bringing us closer to the truth or further away? Are they bringing us closer to freedom or are they bringing us closer to fixation? Finally, the fourth thought is that all the pleasures in this life, as the fourth thought says, is like the last meal of a condemned person. Think of that that way. Every pleasure you have or have taken is like the last meal of a condemned man. Further, the only thing we're going to carry into the next world is the imprints of our actions in this. The fact is, and this is a hard one to recognize, the fact is the Karmapa said, if you only want to accomplish benefit in this life, you don't need Dharma. If all you're concerned about is this life and its accomplishments, you don't need the Dharma. All you need to do, if you want to be a great doctor, you go study what doctors study. If you want to be a great therapist, study what a therapist studies. So you learn the ways of the world and you train in those. On the other hand, the Dharma practitioner's chief concern is longer term, future lives, and ultimately liberation and the liberation of all beings. We're not going to be Milarepa, okay? But we can lessen our fixation on the worldly details that bog us down, that we fixate on. We do the things we need to do, but maybe with a little lighter touch. Now, there are, I am sure, people in this room that right now are not sure there are such a thing as future lives, and that's okay. It's okay. Don't have to worry about that. You can still practice, and practice what you see as being beneficial to you. You don't have to right now believe in future lives. Those prayers of aspiration for the world, that creates merit for you. And with that merit, gradually you may develop the ability to hold a deeper view. But no matter what, you know the simple acquisition of wealth will never create lasting happiness. I mean, this seems to be a secret among the worldly folk. You know, Elon Musk is, I've got billions and billions of dollars and he still wants more. Apparently thinking that that's going to make him and everybody else happy, I don't know. But you and I, you wouldn't be here if you didn't think this. You and I know that the simple acquisition of wealth is going to make you lastingly happy. You know that. That's why you're here. So as the Karmapa said, and this is a little off the subject, but it is on the subject. He says, if meditation is attached to this life, no matter how much meditation one does, the meditation only serves to reinforce attachment and fixation to worldly things and no other purpose. No other purpose. So if you sit down and meditate thinking, you know, this is going to help my job. I mean, that's fine. Nothing wrong with that. But ultimately, all it's going to do is make you more fixated upon your job. Now, there are secondary benefits to meditation, and we all know those about blood pressure and so forth and so on. But from a Dharma perspective, we're meditating for a different reason. We're meditating for our total and complete liberation, for our ultimate happiness. All the other things, I'm not saying any of that's bad. I'm just saying the truth is, if our motivation is worldly, it's simply our meditation will reinforce those worldly pursuits and fixate on them. The prayer speaks of severing all ties to this life. So we want freedom. Freedom is a gate to happiness. What controls us binds us to unhappiness. Okay, so I have a dog named Lucy. And she loves to be outside. So I take her outside And I pound the stake in the ground and tie her leash to it, and she goes running around. That stake is like our fixation on this life. It binds us, it keeps us from moving. Now in Lucy's case, it's a little different. In Lucy's case, it keeps her from biting the mailman. But in our case, the analogy is that our fixation on worldly things exclusively puts us in the position of just going around in circles all the time. And so our masters are pointing out, let's pull up that stake and let's take the path towards liberation. The third verse. Devotion is the head of meditation, it is taught. To the meditator who always turns to him, grant your blessing that uncontrived devotion be born within. Okay, so what does that mean? Devotion to the guru is a means to Mahamudra. In the Tibetan language, it's mugu. It's written in the prayer, mugu. Mu means great appreciation or longing for, and gu means respect. Milarepa had respect and devotion for his teacher and for the Dharma. First of all, because he knew the results of his action would result in horrible future lives. So he was well motivated. But he had devotion to a path that purified all of those defects. So again, how much devotion we have depends upon the power of our own mind to generate it and our mental capacities. Now, if you're a person that always tries to see the faults in other people, you're going to have a hard time being devoted to anybody or anything. So the first problem is our own fault finding in just everybody. That's the first problem. We're not even talking about devotion to the teacher right now. We're talking about to one another. So the first thing we got to work on is being devoted to, respectful of, compassionate with each other. That can lead to our starting to see the Buddha nature in everybody, that we have this Buddha nature in us, and I can see it in you. Now, if I'm always looking for faults, I'll never see it. That's a pure view. And it takes practice, and it takes familiarization with it. But it's the way, it's the path to being devoted to a teacher, to someone that's going to reveal the truth to you. So we start seeing each other in a kinder way. And then when the kind teacher comes along, we can believe in them. Now, we use the word guru here, and that's someone who has realization and can impart it to the student. When we choose our gurus, we have to be very careful and investigate for time. That's important. But when we find that person, that teacher that we trust, we can't be looking at their faults, but only looking at their good qualities and try to bring those into our own way of living. I remember the first time I ever met Kempo Karcha Rinpoche. It was actually October of, I think it's 1999. I saw him and I said, that's who I want to be when I grow up. And that's sort of what it's like when you find your guru. Now, right now in the beginning here, you and I may not need a guru. We just need a good spiritual friend we can trust in that is at least a couple of steps ahead of us spiritually. So the folks downstairs that teach beginning classes, they'll admit to you as much as I admit to you that we're ordinary folk. But maybe we can help you because we're one or two steps ahead of you. And from that perspective, you can actually have devotion, respect, and love for those teachers also. They say in our tradition that simply having devotion can be sufficient. And that makes sense, doesn't it? If we find that realized teacher, recognize their qualities, and become truly devoted to them, we'll want to bring those qualities into our own self. And that's sufficient. Devotion can be sufficient. We want the qualities of the great teacher. So it's sort of like this. Our spiritual forefathers have prepared a meal for us. Everything's ready to be eaten, and it's our responsibility to eat. It's not their responsibility. They can't do it for us. So the next verse is about non-distraction. Let's see if I can find it here. Here it's called unwavering attention. Unwavering attention is a body of meditation. It is taught whatever rises is a fresh nature of thought. To the meditator who rests there in naturalness, grant your blessing that meditation be free from intellectualization. So that's the next step in our path towards Mahamudra, meeting our true self, our Buddha nature. And in this verse, it's called the body. It's the main part of Mahamudra. Any Buddhist practice we do in this building requires a certain amount of non-distraction. And some of us have it to a better degree than others, but some degree of it is necessary. So this section is really about shamatha. As the Karmapa says, holding positive intentions and views, while excellent, do not lead progress beyond an initial point. We need the quality of non-distraction. So how do we develop it? Well, there are two ways. One way is we could do like our spiritual forefathers and go off into meditation caves and spend 18 years. Not. I mean, who knows? Who knows? Maybe. But probably not. We can, on the other hand, we can meditate every day. And we can aspire to do longer meditation retreats. Slowly, slowly, slowly. You don't want to do something like I did. My first retreat, first time out, went to a 2-week silent retreat. Never had meditated before in my life. Not a good idea. don't do that. I wound up with sore knees and saying, I don't know if I ever want to do this again. So begin that process of meditation slowly. But there's another way, according to the Karmapa. Besides doing our daily practice of meditation, there's something else we can do, and we do it off the cushion. We tend to think that off the cushion is non-meditation. So what we could do what we think about when we are off the cushion is, I can't meditate. And the Karmapas tells us is we might want to change that view. We might want to think a little different about that. Because not only did our spiritual forefathers go into long retreats, they also placed their awareness on the moving mind when it was moving, and awareness on the resting mind when it rests. That sounds a little complicated, so let me make that real simple. When you're walking, you're paying attention to walking. When you're eating, you're mindful of your eating. When you're doing work of any kind, you're mindful of that. And in that way, we start developing mindfulness and awareness. And those two are the guardians of our meditation. We're not trying to create any kind of special woo-woo kind of world. It's not out there. It is being mindful of what you are doing right now. It's an ordinary state we're trying to develop. So what we do off the cushion is submit ourselves to the discipline of being watchful and being mindful. And the practice is to keep returning to that center I spoke of time and time again, and never giving up doing that. Familiarizing ourselves with that process of returning to whatever it is we're doing. I drove here this morning from Zanesville, and I was thinking about this. But before I was thinking about this, my mind was all over the place. I was thinking about, you know, whether I wasn't driving really. It's sort of scary, I guess. And we do that all the time, right? So it's just about paying attention, being aware and mindful of what we are doing, and when our mind strays, returning to the center. A thousand times, 100,000 times every day. But it becomes easier and easier over the long haul, not to worry. The analogy is the dog and the lion when they're thrown a stone. Well, let me do better. Lucy, my dog Lucy, I'll throw a teddy bear down the hallway. She'll grab it and bring it back to me. I'll throw it again. She'll run after it and bring it back. And she does that until she's exhausted. Now, if a lion were in my living room and I threw the teddy, would the lion go for the teddy? He'd go for me. So it's like that. It's like that. When thoughts arise, instead of rushing after them, return to the self. Return to the center. That's the practice. Now, the last verse I'm not even going to go into. You know why I'm not going to go into it? Because it's about Vipassana. And I'm not really qualified to teach that last verse. Now, Kempo Ergen, who's coming at the end of the month, he could answer these questions about that. And I challenge you to ask him about that last verse. It's profound. And as I said this morning, I'm sort of like Naropa. I understand each word and it's, you know, what it says. But do I understand the meaning of that verse? No. And to understand it, you've got to have experienced it. Now, I'm not discouraging you from reading that. In fact, read it many times. and familiarize yourself with those words. But right now, I'm not going to try to teach from it. So what I'd like to do, and I'd ask Mama Kathy if she didn't mind, it's beautiful. It's absolutely gorgeous, the chant for this prayer. And I've asked Lama Kathy if she would not lead us in that chant. And you can follow along. And we'll do it in Tibetan. And I'm going to give you the microphone, Lama Kathy.
Can you hear me okay?
Okay.
Oh.
So let's do the dedication of merit. Thank all of you for your kind attention. I wish you a really good week, and come on back and see us again. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.